offering one of the cigarettes with a flourish. "This is India, country of the poor fellows. No need for buying whole packet of cigarettes here. Just one cigarette you can buy only, and no need for buying it any matches." He leaned forward and took up a length of smouldering hemp rope that was hanging from a hook on the telegraph pole next to the cigarette stall. Prabhakar blew the ash from the end of it, exposing a little orange ember of fire, which he used to puff his cigarette alight. "What is he making? What are they chewing in those leaves?"
"It's called pan. The most very excellent taste, and chewing it is. Everyone in Bombay is chewing and more spitting, no problem, day and night also. Very good for health it is. Plenty of chewing and full spitting. You want to try it? I will get it for you, Sam."
I nodded and let him make the order, not so much for the new experience of the pan as for the excuse it offered to stand there longer and look at Carla. She was so relaxed and at home, so much a part of the street and its inscrutable lore. What I found bewildering all around me seemed to be mundane for her. I was reminded of the foreigner in the slum, the man I'd seen from the window of the bus. Like him, she seemed calm and content in Bombay. She seemed to belong. I envied her the warmth and acceptance she drew from those around her. But more than that, my eyes were drawn to her perfect loveliness. I looked at her, a stranger, and every other breath strained to force its way from my chest. A clamp like a tightening fist seized my heart. A voice in my blood said, "Yes, yes, yes." The ancient Sanskrit legends speak of a destined love, a karmic connection between souls that are fated to meet and collide and enrapture one another. The legends say that the loved one is instantly recognized because she's loved in every gesture, every expression of thought, every movement, every sound, and every mood that prays in her eyes. The legends say that we know her by her wings, the wings that only we can see, and because wanting her kills every other desire of love. The same legends also carry warnings that such fated love may sometimes be the possession and the obsession of one, and only one, of the two souls twinned by destiny. But wisdom, in one sense, is the opposite of love. Love survives in us precisely because it isn't wise.
"Ah, you looked at girl,"
Prabhakar observed, returning with the pan and following the direction of my gaze.
"You think she is beautiful, nah? Her name is Carla."
"You know her?"
"Oh, yes. Carla is everybody knows,"
he replied, in a stage whisper so loud that I feared she might hear.
"You want to meet her?"
"Meet her?"
"If you want it, I will speak to her. You want her to be your friend?"
"What?"
"Oh, yes. Carla is my friend, and she will be your friend also, I think so. Maybe you will make a lot of money for your very good self in business with Carla. Maybe you will become such good and closely friends that you will have it a lot of sexes together and make a full enjoyment of your bodies. I am sure you will have a friendly pleasure."
He was actually rubbing his hands together. The red juices of the pan stained the teeth and lips of his smile. I had to grasp at his arm to stop him from approaching her, there in the group of her friends.
"No, stop. For Christ's sake, keep your voice down, Prabhakar. If I want to speak to her, I'll do it myself."
"Oh, I am understand," he said, looking abashed. "It is what foreigners are calling foreplay, isn't it?"
"No, foreplay is... Never mind what foreplay is."
"Oh, good. I never mind about the foreplays, Mr. Lindsay. I am an Indian fellow, and we Indian fellows, we don't worry about our foreplayings. We go straight to the bumping and jumping. Oh, yes."
He was holding an imaginary woman in his hands and thrusting his narrow hips at her, smiling that red-juiced smile all the while.
"Will you stop that?"
I snapped, looking up to see if Carla and her friends were watching him.
"Okay, Mr. Lindsay,"
he sighed, slowing his rhythmic thrusts until they stopped altogether.
"But I can still make a good offer of your friendship to the Miss Carla, if you like."
"No, I mean, no, thank you." I don't want to proposition her. Oh, God, what's the use? Just tell me, the man who's talking now, what language is he speaking?
He is speaking Hindi language, Mr. Lindsay. You wait 1 minute, I will tell you what is it he is saying.
He moved to the far side of the stall and joined her group, quite unselfconsciously, leaning in to listen. No one paid any attention to him. He nodded, laughed with the others, and returned after a few minutes.
He is telling it one very funny story about an inspector of Bombay police, a very great powerful fellow in this area. That inspector did lock up a very clever fellow in his jail, but the clever fellow, he did convince the inspector to let him out again, because he told the inspector he had some gold and jewels. Not only that, but when he was free, the clever fellow sold the inspector some of the gold and some jewels. But they were not really gold and not really jewels. They were the imitations and very cheaply not the really things. And the worst mischief, the clever fellow lived in the inspector's house for 1 week before he sold the not really jewels. And there is a big rumor that the clever fellow had sexy business with that inspector's wife. Now the inspector is crazy and so much angry that everyone is running when they see him.
How do you know her? Does she live here?
Know who, Mr. Lindsay? That inspector's wife?
No, of course not. I mean the girl, Carla. You know, he mused, frowning hard for the first time,
there are lots of girls in this Bombay. We are only 5 minutes from your hotel. In this 5 minutes, we have seen it hundreds of girls. In 5 minutes more, there's more hundreds of girls. Every 5 minutes, more hundreds of girls. And after a little of walking, we will see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
Oh, hundreds of girls. Great, I interrupted sarcastically, my voice much louder than I'd intended it to be. I glanced around. Several people were staring at me with undisguised contempt. I continued in a hushed tone. I don't want to know about hundreds of girls, Prabhakar. I'm just curious about that girl, okay?
Okay, Mr. Lindsay, I will be telling you everything. Carla, she is a famous businessman in Bombay. Very long she is here. I think 5 years maybe. She has one small house not far. Everybody knows the Carla.
Where is she from?
I think German or something like that.
But she sounded American.
Yes, is sounding, but she is from German, or like to the German. And now anyway is almost very Indian. You want to eat your foods now?
Yeah, just a minute. The group of young friends called out their goodbyes to others near the pan stand and walked off into the mill and swirl of the crowd. Carla joined them, walking away with her head held high in that curiously straight-backed, almost defiant posture. I watched her until she was swallowed by the people tide of the crowds. But she never looked back. Do you know a place called Leopold? I asked Prabhakar as he joined me, and we started to walk once more.
Oh, yes. Wonderful and lovely place it is, Leopold's beer bar. Full of the most wonderful, lovely peoples. The very, very fine and lovely people. All kind of foreigners you can find there. All making good business. Sexy business and drugs business and money business and black market business and naughty pictures and smuggler business and passport business and... Okay, Prabhakar, I get it. You want to go there?
No, maybe later. I stopped walking and Prabhakar stopped beside me. Listen, what do your friends call you? I mean, what's your name for short instead of Prabhakar?
Oh, yes, short name I am having also. My short name is Prabhu.
Prabhu. I like it.
It's meaning the son of light, or like to that. Is good name, yes?
Is good name, yes.
And your good name, Mr. Lindsay, it is really not so good if you don't mind I'm telling your face. I don't like it, this long and kind of a squeaky name for Indian people speaking.
Oh, you don't?
Sorry to say it, no. I don't. Not at all. Not a bit. Not even a dinsy or a weensy.
Well, I smiled, I'm afraid there's not a lot I can do about it.
I'm thinking that a short name, Lin, is much better, he suggested. If you're not having objections, I will call you Lin.
It was as good a name as any, and no more or less false than the dozen others I'd assumed since the escape. In fact, in recent months I'd found myself reacting with a quirky fatalism to the new names I was forced to adopt, in one place or another, and to the new names that others gave me. Lin. It was a diminutive I never could have invented for myself. But it sounded right, which is to say that I heard the voodoo echo of something ordained, fated, a name that instantly belonged to me, as surely as the lost secret name with which I was born, and under which I'd been sentenced to 20 years in prison. I peered down into Prabhakar's round face and his large, dark, mischievous eyes, and I nodded, smiled, and accepted the name. I couldn't know, then, that the little Bombay street guide had given me a name thousands of people, from Colaba to Kandahar, from Kinshasa to Berlin, would come to know me by. Fate needs accomplices, and the stones in destiny's walls are mortared with small and heedless complicities such as those. I look back now, and I know that the naming moment, which seemed so insignificant then, which seemed to demand no more than an arbitrary and superstitious yes or no, was in fact a pivotal moment in my life. The role I played under that name, and the character I became, Lin Baba, was more real and true to my nature than anyone or anything that I ever was before it. Yes, okay. Lin will do.
Very good. I am too happy that you like it, this name. And like my name is meaning son of light in Hindi language, your name, Lin, has it also a very fine and so lucky meaning.
Yeah? What does Lin mean in Hindi?
It's meaning penis, he explained, with a delight that he expected me to share.
Oh, great. That's just great.
Yes, very great, very lucky. It is not exactly meaning this, but it is sounding like Ling or Lingam, and that is meaning penis.
Come off it, man, I protested, beginning to walk once more. How can I go around calling myself Mr. Penis? Are you kidding me? I can see it now. Oh, hello, pleased to meet you. My name is Penis. No way, forget it. I think we'll stick to Lindsay.
No, no, Lin, really, I'm telling you, this is a fine name, a very power name, very lucky, a too lucky name. The people will love this name when they hear it. Come, I will show you. I want to leave it this bottle of whiskey you gave to me. Leave it with my friend, Mr. Sanjay. Here, just here in this shop. Just you see how he likes it, your name.
A few more paces along the busy street brought us to a small shop with a hand-painted sign over the open door. Radio Sick. Electric Repair Enterprises. Electrical Sales and Repairs. Sanjay Deshpande, proprietor. Sanjay Deshpande was a heavy-set man in his 50s, with a halo of grey-white hair and white bushy eyebrows. He sat behind a solid wooden counter, surrounded by bomb-blast radios, eviscerated cassette players, and boxes of parts. Prabhakar greeted him, chattering in rapid Hindi, and passed the bottle of whiskey over the counter. Mr. Deshpande slapped a meaty hand on it, without looking at it, and slid it out of sight on his side of the counter. He took a sheaf of rupee notes from his shirt pocket, peeled off a number, and passed them across with his palm turned downward. Prabhakar took the money and slipped it into his pocket with a movement as swift and fluid as the tentacle grab of a squid. He finished talking at last and beckoned me forward.
"This is my very good friend," he informed Mr.
Deshpande, patting me on the arm.
"He's from New Zealand."
Mr. Deshpande grunted.
"He is just today coming in Bombay. In their guest house he is staying."
Mr. Deshpande grunted again. He studied me with a vaguely hostile curiosity.
"His name is Lin, Mr. Lin Baba," Prabhakar said. "What's his name?"
Mr. Deshpande asked.
"Lin,"
Prabhakar grinned.
His name is Lin Baba."
Mr. Deshpande raised his impressive eyebrows in a surprised smile.
"Lin Baba?"
"Oh, yes," Prabhaka enthused. Lin, very fine fellow he is also."
Mr. Deshpande extended his hand, and I shook it. We greeted one another, and then Prabhaka began to tug at my sleeve, pulling me towards the doorway.
"Lin Baba,"
Mr. Deshpande called out, as we were about to step into the street.
"Welcome in Bombay. You have any Walkman or camera or any ghetto blasting machine for selling? You come to me, Sanjay Deshpande, at the Radio Sikh. I am giving best prices."
I nodded, and we left the shop. Prabhaka dragged me a few paces further along the street, and then stopped.
"You see, Mr. Lin, you see how he likes it, your name."
"I guess so," I muttered, bewildered as much by his enthusiasm as by the brief exchange with Mr. Deshpande. When I got to know him well enough, when I began to cherish his friendship, I discovered that Prabhaka believed with the whole of his heart that his smile made a difference in people's hearts and in the world. He was right, of course, but it took me a long time to understand that truth and to accept it. "What's the Baba part at the end of the name? Lin, I can understand, but what's the Lin Baba bit all about?"
"Baba is just a respecting name," Prabhaka grinned. "If we put Baba up on the back of your name, or on the name of anybody special, it is like meaning the respect we give to a teacher, or a holy person, or a very old...
I get it. But it doesn't make me any more comfortable with it, Prabhu, I gotta tell you. This whole penis thing, I don't know."
"But you did see Mr. Sanjay Deshpande. You did see how he liked it, your name. Look, see how the people loved his name. You see now, you look, I will tell it to everybody. Lin Baba! Lin Baba! Lin Baba!"
He was speaking in a shout, addressing strangers as they passed us on the street.
"All right, Prabhu, all right. I take your word for it. Calm down."
It was my turn to tug at his sleeve and move him along the street. "I thought you wanted to drink the whiskey."
"Ah, yes," he sighed. "Was wanting it and was already drinking it in my mind also. But now, Lin Baba, with this money from selling your good present to Mr. Sanjay, I can buy 2 bottles of very bad and nicely cheap Indian whiskey to enjoy, and plenty of money left for 1 nice new shirt. Red colour, $1 of good charas, tickets for enjoying air-conditioned Hindi picture, and 2 days of foods. But wait, Lin Baba, you are not eating at your pan. You must put it now in the side of your mouth and chew it before it is getting stale and not good for taste."
"Okay, how do I do it? Like this?" I put the leaf-wrapped parcel, almost the size of a matchbox, into the side of my mouth between the cheek and the teeth, as I'd seen the others do. Within seconds, a suffusion of aromatic sweetnesses possessed my mouth. The taste was sharp and luscious, honeyed and subtly piquant at the same time. The leaf wrapping began to dissolve, and the solid, crunchy nibbles of shaved betel nut, date and coconut swirled in the sweet juices.
"You must spit it out some pan now," Prabhaka said,
staring at my grinding jaws with earnest concentration.
"You make like this, see? Spit him out like this."
He spat out a squirt of red juice that landed on the road a meter away and formed a palm-sized blotch. It was a precise, expert procedure. Not a speck of the juice remained on his lips. With his enthusiastic encouragement, I tried to imitate him, but the mouthful of crimson liquid bubbled out of my mouth, left a trail of slobber on my chin and the front of my shirt, and landed with an audible splat on my right boot.
"No problem, this shirt,"
Prabhaka frowned, pulling a handkerchief from his pocket and smearing the blood-red fluid deeper into my shirt front with vigorously ineffective rubbing.
"No problem, your boots also. I will wipe him just like this, see? I must ask it now, do you like the swimming?"
"Swimming?" I asked, swallowing the little pan mixture that was still in my mouth.
"Oh yes, swimming. I will take you to Chaupati Beach. So nice beach it is, and there you can practice chewing and spitting and chewing and more spitting the pan, but without so many of all your clothes, only for a good saving on your laundry."
"Listen, about that going around the city, You work as a guide, right?
Oh, yes. Very best Bombay guide and guiding all India also.
How much do you charge per day? He glanced at me, his cheeks appled in the impish grin I was learning to recognise as the clever underside of his broad and gentle smile.
I charge 100 rupees all day, he said.
Okay.
And tourist buy it the lunch.
Sure.
And taxi also, tourist pay.
Of course.
And Bombay bus tickets all day pay.
Yep.
And chai, if we drink it on a hot afternoon for refreshing our good selves.
Uh-huh.
And sexy girls, if we go there on a cool night, if we are feeling a bit needy, swelling and up.
Yeah, okay. Listen, I'll pay you for the whole week. I want you to show me Bombay. Teach me a bit about the city. If it works out okay, there'll be a bonus for you at the end of the week. How does that sound? The smile sparked his eyes, but his voice was surprisingly somber as he replied.
This is your good decision, Lin Baba. Your very good decision.
Well, I laughed, we'll see. And I want you to teach me some Hindi words, okay?
Oh, yes, I can teach everything. Ha means yes, and nahi means no, and pani means water, and kana means foods, and...
Okay, we don't have to learn it all at once. Is this the restaurant? Good, I'm starved. I was about to enter the dark and unprepossessing restaurant when he stopped me, his expression suddenly grave. He frowned and swallowed hard, as if he was unsure how to begin.
Before we are eating this good foods, he said at last, before we make any business also, something there is, I must tell it to you.
Okay. His manner was so dejected that I felt a twinge of apprehension.
Well, now I am telling. That Tola Charas, the one I was selling to you in hotel.
Yes.
Well, that was the business price. The really price, the friendship price, is only 50 rupees for $1 Afghani charas.
He lifted his arms and then let them slap down at his thighs.
I charged it 50 rupees too much.
I see, I answered quietly. The matter was so trivial from my point of view that I was tempted to laugh out loud. It was obviously important to him, however, and I suspected that he wasn't often moved to make such admissions. In fact, as he told me much later, Prabhakar had just then decided to like me, and for him that meant he was bound to a scrupulous and literal honesty in everything he said or did. It was at once his most endearing and most irritating quality that he always told me the whole of the truth. So, what do you want to do about it?
My suggestion, he said seriously. We smoke it, that business price charas, very fast, until finish that one. Then I will buy new one for us. After from now, it will be everything friendship prices, for you and for me also. This is a no-problem policy, isn't it?
I laughed, and he laughed with me. I threw my arm around his shoulder and led him into the steamy, ambrosial activity of the busy restaurant.
Lin, I think I am your very good friend, Prabhakar decided, grinning happily. We are the lucky fellows, isn't it?
Maybe it is, I replied. Maybe it is. Hours later, I lay back in a comfortable darkness, under the sound strobe of a ceaselessly revolving ceiling fan. I was tired, but I couldn't sleep. Beneath my windows, the street that had writhed and toiled in daylight was silent, subdued by a night sultriness, moist with stars. Astounding and puzzling images from the city tumbled and turned in my mind like leaves on a wave of wind, and my blood so thrilled with hope and possibility that I couldn't suppress a smile lying there in the dark. No one in the world I'd left behind me knew where I was. No one in the new world of Bombay knew who I was. In that moment, in those shadows, I was almost safe. I thought of Prabhakar and his promise to return early in the morning to begin my tours of the city. Will he come? I wondered. Or will I see him somewhere later in the day, walking with another newly arrived tourist? I decided, with the faint, impersonal callousness of the lonely, that if he were as good as his word and turned up in the morning, I would begin to like him. I thought of the woman, Carla, again and again, surprised that her composed, unsmiling face intruded so often.
If you go to Leopold sometime, maybe you'll find out.
That was the last thing she'd said to me. I didn't know if it was an invitation, a challenge, or a warning. Whatever it was, I meant to take her up on it. I meant to go there and look for her. But not yet. Not until I'd learned a little more about the city she seemed to know so well. I'll give it a week, I thought. A week in the city. And beyond those reflections, as always, in fixed orbits around the cold sphere of my solitude, were thoughts of my family and my friends. Endless. Unreachable. Every night was twisted around the unquenchable longing of what my freedom had cost me, and all that was lost. Every night was pierced by the spike of shame for what my freedom continued to cost them, the loved ones I was sure I would never see again.
We could have beat him down, you know, the tall Canadian said from his dark corner on the far side of the room, his sudden voice in the whirring silence sounding like stones thrown on a metal roof. We could have beat that manager down on the price of this room. It's costing us $6 for the day. We could have beat him down to $4. It's not a lot of money, but it's the way they do things here. You gotta beat these guys down and barter for everything. We're leaving tomorrow for Delhi, but you're staying here. We talked about it before, when you were out, and we're kind of worried about you. You gotta beat them down, man. If you don't learn that, if you don't start thinking like that, they're gonna fuck you over, these people. The Indians in the cities are real mercenary, man. It's a great country, don't get me wrong. That's why we come back here. But they're different than us. They're... hell, they just expect it, that's all. You gotta beat them down.
He was right about the price of the room, of course. We could have saved a dollar or two per day, and haggling is the economical thing to do. Most of the time, it's the shrewd and amiable way to conduct your business in India. But he was wrong, too. The manager, Anand, and I became good friends in the years that followed. The fact that I trusted him on sight and didn't haggle on that first day, that I didn't try to make a buck out of him, that I worked on an instinct that respected him and was prepared to like him, endeared me to him. He told me so more than once. He knew, as we did, that $6 of our dollars wasn't an extravagant price for 3 foreign men to pay. The owners of the hotel received $4 per day per room. That was their baseline. The dollar or two above that minimum was all Anand and his staff of 3 room boys shared as their daily wage. The little victories haggled from him by foreign tourists cost Anand his daily bread and cost them the chance to know him as a friend. The simple and astonishing truth about India and Indian people is that when you go there and deal with them, your heart always guides you more wisely than your head. There's nowhere else in the world where that's quite so true. I didn't know that then, as I closed my eyes in the dark and breathing silence on that first night in Bombay. I was running on instinct and pushing my luck. I didn't know that I'd already given my heart to the woman and the city. And knowing none of it, I fell, before the smile faded from my lips, into a dreamless, gentle sleep. Chapter 2. She walked into Leopold's at the usual time, and when she stopped at a table near me to talk with friends, I tried once more to find the words for the foliant blaze of her green eyes. I thought of leaves and opals and the warm shallows of island seas. But the living emerald in Carla's eyes, made luminous by the sunflowers of gold light that surrounded the pupils, was softer, far softer. I did eventually find that colour, the green in nature that was a perfect match for the green in her lovely eyes. But it wasn't until long months after that night in Leopold's. And strangely, inexplicably, I didn't tell her about it. I wish now with all my heart that I did. The past reflects eternally between two mirrors, the bright mirror of words and deeds, and the dark one, full of things we didn't do or say. I wish now that from the beginning, even then in the first weeks that I knew her, even on that night, the words had come to tell her. To tell her that I liked her. And I did. I liked everything about her. I liked the Helvetian music of her Swiss-American English, and the way she pushed her hair back slowly with a thumb and forefinger when she was irritated by something. I liked the hard-edged cleverness of her conversation, and the easy, gentle way she touched the people she liked when she walked past them or sat beside them. I liked the way she held my eyes until the precise moment when it stopped being comfortable, and then smiled, softening the assail, but never looked away. She looked the world in the eye and stared it down, and I liked that about her because I didn't love the world then. The world wanted to kill me or catch me. The world wanted to put me back in the same cage I'd escaped from, where the good guys, the guys in prison guard uniforms who got paid to do the right thing, had chained me to a wall and kicked me until they broke my bones. And maybe the world was right to want that. Maybe it was no worse than I deserved. But repression, they say, breeds resistance in some men. And I was resisting the world with every minute of my life.
"The world and I are not on speaking terms," Carlo said to me once in those early months. "The world keeps trying to win me back," she said. "But it doesn't work. I guess I'm just not the forgiving type."
And I saw that in her too, right from the start. I knew from the first minute how much like me she was. I knew the determination in her that was almost brutal, and the courage that was almost cruel, and the lonely, angry longing to be loved. I knew all that, but I didn't say a word. I didn't tell her how much I liked her. I was numb in those first years after the escape, shell-shocked by the disasters that warred in my life. My heart moved through deep and silent water. No one and nothing could really hurt me. No one and nothing could make me very happy. I was tough, which is probably the saddest thing you can say about a man.
"You're becoming a regular here,"
she teased, ruffling my hair with one hand as she sat down at my table. I loved it when she did that. It meant that she'd read me accurately, that she was sure I wouldn't take offense. I was 30 then. Ugly, taller than average, with wide shoulders, a deep chest, and thick arms. People didn't often ruffle my hair. "Yeah, I guess I am."
"So, you went around on tour with Prabhakar again. How was it today?"
"He took me to the island, Elephanta, to see the caves."
"A beautiful place,"
she remarked quietly, looking at me but dreaming of something else.
"If you get the chance, you should visit the Ajanta and Ellora caves in the north of the state. I spent the night there once, at Ajanta, in one of the caves. My boss took me there."
"Your boss?"
"Yes, my boss."
"Is he European, your boss, or Indian?"
"Neither one, actually."
"Tell me about him."
"Why?"
she asked, with a direct, frowning stare. I was simply making conversation, trying to keep her near me, talking to me. And the sudden wariness that bristled in the single word of her question surprised me.
It's no big deal, I replied, smiling. I'm just curious about how people get work here. How they make a living, that's all.
Well, I met him 5 years ago, on a long-distance flight, she said, looking down at her hands and seeming to relax once more. We both got on the plane at Zurich. I was on my way to Singapore, but by the time we got to Bombay, he'd convinced me to get off the plane and work for him. The trip to the caves was something special. He arranged it somehow with the authorities, and I went up there with him and spent the night in a big cave full of stone sculptures of the Buddha and 1,000 chattering bats. I was safe. He had a bodyguard posted outside. But it was incredible, a fantastic experience. And it really helped me to put things in focus. Sometimes you break your heart in the right way, if you know what I mean.
I wasn't sure what she meant, but when she paused, expecting a reply, I nodded as if I did understand.
You learn something or you feel something completely new when you break your heart that way, she said. Something that only you can know or feel in that way. And I knew after that night, I would never have that feeling anywhere but India. I knew, I can't explain it, I just knew somehow that I was home and warm and safe. And, well, I'm still here.
What kind of business is he in?
What?
Your boss, what does he do?
Imports, she said. And exports.
She lapsed into silence, turning her head to scan the other tables. Do you miss your home?
My home?
Yeah, I mean your other home. Don't you ever get homesick for Switzerland?
In a way, yes, I do. I come from Basel. Have you ever been there?
No, I've never been to Europe.
Well, you must go. And when you go there, you must visit Basel. It's really a very European city, you know? It's divided by the River Rhine into Great Basel and Small Basel. And the two halves of the city have really different styles and attitudes. So it's like living in two cities at the same time. That used to suit me once. And it's right on the meeting place of three countries. So you can just walk across the border into Germany and France. You can have breakfast in France, you know, with coffee and baguettes, and lunch in Switzerland and dinner in Germany, without leaving the city by more than a few kilometers. I miss Basel more than I miss Switzerland.
She stopped, catching her breath, and looked up at me through soft, unpainted lashes.
Sorry, I'm giving you a geography lesson here.
No, no, please go on. It's interesting.
You know, she said slowly, I like you, Lynn.
She stared that green fire into me. I felt myself reddening slightly, not from embarrassment, but from shame, that she'd said so easily the very words, I like you, that I wouldn't let myself say to her. You do? I asked, trying to make the question sound more casual than it was. I watched her lips close in a thin smile.
Yes, you're a good listener. That's dangerous because it's so hard to resist. Being listened to, really listened to, is the second best thing in the world.
What's the first best thing?
Everybody knows that. The best thing in the world is power.
Oh, is it? I asked, laughing. What about sex?
No. Apart from the biology, sex is all about power. That's why it's such a rush.
I laughed again. And what about love? A lot of people say that love is the best thing in the world, not power.
They're wrong, she said, with terse finality. Love is the opposite of power. That's why we fear it so much.
Carla, dear one, the things you say,
Didier Levy said, joining us and taking a seat beside Carla. I must make the conclusion that you have wicked intentions for Arlene.
You didn't hear a word we said, she chided.
I don't have to hear you. I can see by the look on his face. You've been talking your riddles to him and turning his head around. You forget, Carla, that I know you too well. Here, Lynn, we'll cure you at once.
He shouted to one of the red-jacketed waiters, calling the man by the number 4 emblazoned on the breast pocket on his uniform.
Hey, char number, do butly beer. What will you have, Carla? Coffee? Oh, char number, ek coffee or jaldi caro.
Didier Levy was only 35 years old, but those years were stitched to him in lumpy wads of flesh and deep lines that gave him the plump and careworn look of a much older man. In defiance of the humid climate, he always wore baggy canvas trousers, a denim shirt, and a rumpled grey woolen sports coat. His thick, curly black hair never seemed to be shorter or longer than the line of his collar, just as the stubble on his tired face never seemed to be less than 3 days from its last shave. He spoke a lavishly accented English, using the language to provoke and criticise friend and stranger alike with an indolent malignity. There were people who resented his rudeness and rebukes, but they tolerated them because he was frequently useful and occasionally indispensable. He knew where everything, from a pistol to a precious gem to a kilo of the finest Thai white heroin, might be bought or sold in the city. And, as he sometimes boasted, there was very little he wouldn't do for the right amount of money, provided there was no significant risk to his comfort and personal safety.
We were talking of the different ideas people have about the best thing in the world, Carla said. But I don't have to ask what you think.
You would say that I think money is the best thing in the world, he suggested lazily. And we'd both be right. Every sane and rational person one day realizes that money is almost everything. The great principles and the noble virtues are all very well in the long run of history, but from one day to the next, it's money that keeps us going, and the lack of it that drives us under the great wheel. And what about you, Lynn? What did you say?
He didn't say anything yet, and now that you're here, he won't get a chance.
Now, be fair, Carla. Tell us, Lynn. I would like to know.
Well, if you press me, I'd have to say freedom.
The freedom to do what?
He asked, putting a little laugh in the last word.
I don't know. Maybe just the freedom to say no. If you've got that much freedom, you really don't need any more.
The beer and coffee arrived. The waiter slammed the drinks onto the table with reckless discourtesy. The service in the shops, hotels and restaurants of Bombay, in those days, moved from a politeness that was charming or fawning to a rudeness that was either abrupt or hostile. The churlishness of Leopold's waiters was legendary.
It's my favourite place in the whole world, Carla once said, to be treated like dirt. A toast, Didier declared, raising his glass to touch mine. To the freedom! To drink! Salut!
He drank half the long glass, let out a loud, wide-mouthed sigh of pleasure, and then drank the rest. He was pouring himself a second glass when two others, a man and a woman, joined our group, sitting between Carla and me. The dark, brooding, undernourished young man was Modena, a dour and taciturn Spaniard who did black market business with French, Italian and African tourists. His companion, a slim and pretty German prostitute named Ulla, had for some time allowed him to call himself her lover.
Ah, Modena, you are just in time to buy the next round, Didier shouted,
reaching past Carla to slap him on the shoulder.
I will have a whiskey and soda, if you please.
The shorter man flinched under the blow and scowled unhappily, but he called the waiter to his side and ordered drinks. Ulla was speaking with Carla in a mixture of German and English that, by accident or intent, obscured the most interesting parts of her conversation.
How could I know it, na? How was it possible for me to know that he was a spinner? Total verrückt, I tell you. At the start, he looked totally straight to me. Or maybe, do you think that was a sign? Maybe he was a little bit too straight-looking. Na ja, 10 minutes in the room, and wollte auf der Klamotten kommen. On my best dress. I had to fight with him to save my clothes. Der Sprintficker. Spritzen wollte all over my clothes. Gibt's ja nicht. And later, when I went to the bathroom for a little sniff of cokes, I came back to see, dass seinem Schwanz ganz tief in einer meiner Schuhe hat. Can you believe it? In my shoe. Nicht zu fassen.
Let's face it, Carla said gently. The crazy ones always know how to find you, Ulla.
Ja, leider. What can I say? Crazy people love me.
Don't listen to her, Ulla, my love, Didier consoled her. Craziness is the basis of many a fine relationship. In fact, craziness is the basis of every fine relationship.
Didier,
Ulla sighed, mouthing his name with a smile of exquisite sweetness.
Have I told you to get fucked yet?
No, he laughed. But I forgive you for the lapse. Between us, my darling, such things are always implied and understood.
The whiskey arrived in 4 small flasks, and the waiter prized the tops off 2 soda bottles with a brass bottle opener that hung from a chain at his belt. He let the tops bounce on the table and fall to the floor, then swished a grimy rag over the wet surface of the table, forcing us to duck and weave as the moisture spilled in all directions. 2 men approached our table from different parts of the restaurant, one to speak to Didier and the other with Modena. Ulla used the moment to lean close to me. Under the table, she pressed something into my hand. It felt like a small roll of banknotes, and her eyes pleaded with me not to draw attention to it. As she talked to me, I slipped the notes into my pocket without looking at them.
So, have you decided how long you're going to stay?
She asked. I don't really know. I'm in no hurry.
Don't you have someone waiting for you somewhere? Or someone you should go to?
She asked, smiling with adroit but passionless coquetry. Seduction was a habit with her. She turned that same smile on her customers, her friends, the waiters, even on Didier, whom she openly disliked. On everyone, in fact, including her lover, Modena. In the months and years that followed, I heard a lot of people criticize Ulla, some of them cruelly, for her flirtations. I didn't agree with them. It seemed to me, as I got to know her well, that she flirted with the world because flirting was the only real kindness she ever knew or shared. It was her way of being nice and of making sure that people, men, were nice to her. She believed that there wasn't enough niceness in the world, and she said so in exactly those words more than once. It wasn't deep feeling and it wasn't deep thinking, but it was right as far as it went, and there was no real harm in it. And what the hell? She was a beautiful girl, and it was a very good smile. No, I lied. There's no one waiting, and no one I should go to.
And don't you have any, wie soll ich das sagen, any program? Any plan?
Not really. I'm working on a book. During the time since the escape, I'd learned that telling people a small part of the truth, that I was a writer, provided me with a useful and flexible cover story. It was vague enough to explain extended stays or sudden departures, and the word research was comprehensive enough to account for inquiries about certain subjects, such as transport and travel, and the availability of false documents that I was sometimes forced to make. Moreover, the cover story guaranteed me a measure of privacy. The simple threat to tell people at length of my work in progress usually discouraged all but the most persistently curious. And I was a writer. In Australia, I'd written since my early 20s. I'd just begun to establish myself through my first published work when my marriage collapsed. I lost the custody of my daughter, and I lost my life in drugs, crime, imprisonment, and escape. But even as a fugitive, writing was still a daily custom and part of my instinctual routine. Even there, in Leopold's, my pockets were full of notes, scribbled onto napkins, receipts, and scraps of paper. I never stopped writing. It was what I did, no matter where I was or how my circumstances changed. One of the reasons I remember those early Bombay months so well is that whenever I was alone, I wrote about those new friends and the conversations we shared. And writing was one of the things that saved me. The discipline and abstraction of putting my life into words every day helped me to cope with shame and its first cousin, despair.
Well, Scheiße, I don't see what's to write about in Bombay. It's no good place, yeah? My friend Lisa says this is the place they were thinking about when they invented the word pits. And I think it is a good place for calling it pits. Better you should go somewhere else to write about, like Rajasthan, maybe. I did hear that it's not a pits there, in Rajasthan.
She's right, Lynn, Carla added. This is not India. There are people here from every part of India, but Bombay isn't India. Bombay is an own world, a world in itself. The real India is out there.
Out there?
Out there, where the light stops.
I'm sure you're right, I answered, smiling in appreciation of the phrase. But I like it here so far. I like big cities, and this is the third biggest city in the world.
You're beginning to sound like your tour guide, Carla joked. I think maybe Prabhaka has been teaching you too well.
I guess he has. He's been filling my head with facts and figures every day for 2 weeks. Quite amazing, really, for a guy who left school when he was 7 and taught himself to read and write here on the streets.
What facts and figures?
Ulla asked.
Well, for instance, the official population of Bombay is 11 million. But Prabhu says the guys who run the illegal numbers racket have a better idea of the real population, and they put it at anything from 13 to 15 million. And there are 200 dialects and languages spoken in the city every day. 200, for God's sake! It's like being in the centre of the world.
As if in response to that talk of languages, Ulla spoke to Carla quickly and intently in German. At a sign from Modena, she stood and gathered her purse and cigarettes. The quiet Spaniard left the table without a word and walked toward the open archway that led to the street.
I have a job, Ulla announced, pouting winsomely. See you tomorrow, Carla. About 11 o'clock, yeah? Maybe we'll have dinner together tomorrow night, Lynn, if you're here. I would like that. Bye. Tschüss.
She walked out after Modena, followed by leers and admiring stares from many of the men in the bar. Didier chose that moment to visit several acquaintances at another table. Carla and I were alone.
She won't, you know.
Won't what?
She won't have dinner with you tomorrow night. It's just her way.
I know, I grinned.
You like her, don't you?
Yeah, I do. What, did that strike you as funny?
In a way, yes. She likes you too.
She paused, and I thought she was about to explain her remark. But when she spoke again, it was to change the subject.
She gave you some money, American dollars. She told me about it in German, so Modena wouldn't understand. You're supposed to give it to me, and she'll collect it from my place at 11 tomorrow.
Okay. Do you want it now?
No, don't give it to me here. I have to go now. I have an appointment. I'll be back in about an hour. Can you wait till then? Or come back and meet me then? You can walk me home if you like.
Sure, I'll be here.
She stood to leave, and I stood also, drawing back her chair. She gave me a little smile, with one eyebrow raised in irony or mockery or both.
I wasn't joking before. You really should leave Bombay.
I watched her walk out to the street and step into the back of a private taxi that had obviously been waiting for her.
as the cream-coloured car eased into the slow stream of night traffic. A man's hand emerged from the passenger window, thick fingers clutching a string of green prayer beads and warning away pedestrians with a wave. Alone again, I sat down, set my chair against the wall, and let the activity of Leopold's and its clamorous patrons close over me. Leopold's was the largest bar and restaurant in Calaba, and one of the largest in the city. The rectangular ground floor room occupied a frontage equal to any four other restaurants, and was served by two metal doors that rolled up into wooden arches to give an expansive view of the causeway, Calaba's busiest and most colourful street. There was a smaller, more discreet, air-conditioned bar on the first floor, supported by sturdy columns that divided the ground floor into roughly equal sections, and around which many of the tables were grouped. Mirrors on those pillars, and on much of the free wall space, provided the patrons with one of the bar's major attractions, the chance to inspect, admire, and ogle others in a circumspect, if not entirely anonymous, fashion. For many, the duplication of their own images in two or more mirrors at the same time was not the least among the pleasures of the pastime. Leopold's was a place for people to see, to be seen, and to see themselves in the act of being seen. There were some 30 tables, all of them topped with pearl-smoked Indian marble. Each table had four or more cedar chairs. 60-minute chairs, Carla used to call them, because they were just uncomfortable enough to discourage customers from staying for more than an hour. A swarm of broad fans buzzed in the high ceiling, stirring the white glass pendulum lights to a slow, majestic sway. Mahogany trim lined the painted walls, surrounded the windows and doors, and framed the many mirrors. Rich fruits used in desserts and juices, pawpaw, papaya, custard apples, mozambi, grapes, watermelon, banana, santra, and in the season, four varieties of mango, were displayed across the whole surface of one wall in gorgeous abundance. A vast solid teak manager's counter presided, like the bridge of a sailing ship, over the busy deck of the restaurant. Behind that, along a narrow corridor, one corner of the frantic kitchen was occasionally visible beyond the scurry of waiters and the sweating clouds of steam. A faded but still sumptuous elegance struck and held the eyes of all who walked through those wide arches into Leopold's little world of light, colour, and richly panelled wood. Its chief splendour was truly admired by none but its humblest workers, however, for it was only when the bar was closed and the cleaners removed all the furniture each morning that the beauty of the floor was exposed. Its intricate tile work replicated the pattern used in a North Indian palace, with hexagons in black, cream, and brown radiating from a central sunburst. And thus, a paving designed for princes, all but invisible to the tourists, with their eyes on their own reflections in the dazzling mirrors, revealed its luxurious perfections only in secret to the naked feet of the cleaners, the city's poorest and meekest working men. For one cool, precious hour each morning after it opened, and the floors had been cleaned, Leopold's was an oasis of quiet in the struggling city. From then, until it closed at midnight, it was constantly crowded with visitors from 100 countries, and the many locals, both foreign and Indian, who came there from every part of the city to conduct their business. The business ranged from traffic in drugs, currencies, passports, gold, and sex, to the intangible but no less lucrative trade in influence. The unofficial system of bribes and favours by which many appointments, promotions, and contracts were facilitated in India. Leopold's was an unofficial free zone, scrupulously ignored by the otherwise efficient officers of the Colaba police station, directly across the busy street. Yet a peculiar dialectic applied to the relationships between upstairs and down, inside and outside the restaurant, and governed all of the business transacted there. Indian prostitutes, garlanded with ropes of jasmine flowers and plumply wrapped in bejeweled saris, were prohibited downstairs, and only accompanied customers to the upstairs bar.
European prostitutes were only permitted to sit downstairs. A trek